Because I know he moved into the Austin area. Are you familiar with Michael Malice?
I mean, I'm aware of Michael Malice, but I haven't really, engaged with him too much.
Okay. One of his little catchphrases he says, and it's kind of true, is, in American politics, conservatives are progressives who are driving the speed limit.
Oh, I have heard that. I didn't know that was his.
Yeah, that's his thing that he said. And I was like, yeah, because it always seems like, okay, so you're conserving whatever it was that was popular 5 minutes ago. Okay. And so you're just saying, hey, slow down. Like, let's, like, the really spooky part, are you already on?
Yeah, partly okay. Partly I like to just start recording. Partly we need to do a sound check.
So this is, cool. We can do that.
But I just will say that, so you can use the term conservative in that way, and I like that idea of progressives who are driving the speed limit. I like that the concept, but what it also just, like, these things are so confused because the Republican Party isn't really, like, if you just equate Republican and conservative, it just doesn't work.
Oh, it doesn't.
There are so many Republicans who aren't driving any type of speed limit. They're just reactionaries. They're just kind of captured by political party.
Well, again, when I would explain to people, like, you know, what a left and right actually mean and everything, I mean, even I like making jokes about politics stuff, about, like, things about left and right things. I don't know if you ever look at Political Compass memes and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. Okay. Are you familiar with the axis of not just left, right, but up and down, authoritarian versus libertarian? Yeah. So here's the thing. I see people make these jokes and they're funny. I genuinely like these kind of jokes.
Right.
But oftentimes it's really interesting to me that the axis that is left and right, with how those were actually envisioned at first, was economically. Like, are you economically left or right? And then, you know, how much authoritarianism versus how much liberty do you want? But I then see people just kind of taking it and just making all kinds of, you know, jokes about it, where they're saying that somebody is, like, culturally left or right. And I'm like, what I've come to realize is that has nothing to do with what they believe economically. Yeah. And so there's people who are considered, quote unquote, far right, that I could make the argument, like, no, they're leftists because, look, they're, like, economically left of, you know, I could make that argument. But I understand that, like, look, again, people mean very different things when they're talking about left and right, which is, honestly, I will say, even if we agree on nothing else, I love the fact that you call your podcast Politically Non-Binary because, yeah, there's, like, this assumption that if somebody has cultural values that are one thing, that they automatically have corresponding ideas that have nothing to do with those. And so, like, there's no reason why we should assume that just because somebody is, you know, more capitalist or socialist on one thing, that they're going to be more traditionalist
about abortion and guns or whatever.
Yeah, like all those kind of things. It's like those have nothing to do with each other.
What up, what up, what up, political NBs and political enemies. That's been my favorite so far thing that I've called y'all. This is an episode. He's going to introduce himself in a second. This is my brother, my libertarian brother. At the end of it, he winds up calling himself a voluntarist. A voluntarialist is what I decided it should be called because I like putting my name into words. And it's cute. But so you'll see about all that. I don't know if you have a libertarian brother or just someone in your life and, you know, you kind of hear those things and you think, don't you want firemen or whatever your reaction is. I think that he makes a lot of great points. I wish I had gotten him to listen to my Freddie DeBoer episode first so that it could also be a little bit of a response to that. Maybe I'll have him do that and then see if he wants to do a follow-up episode where he responds specifically to that episode. But I think this was also just a great way to lay out some of these schools of libertarian thought and libertarian adjacent thought. He really kind of goes over multiple different perspectives on the kind of libertarian worldviews. And so, yeah, it's just a great sort of primer on what's going on in the libertarian world. I feel like I've said the word libertarian too many times now, so I'll stop. But yeah, it was really fun. I enjoy talking to my brother. My brother has a lot to say. He thinks a lot. He reads a lot and listens to a lot of podcasts. And so having him kind of distill down a bunch of thoughts was useful for me. So hopefully you find it useful. There will be more content. coming to you soon on my Patreon and Substack. I know I haven't been doing the greatest job updating it. I just put random things when I can, but I have a new project that I just recorded another episode this morning that inspired me for what I'm going to be doing with my Patreon and Substack. But if you want to support, just because you're being supportive for now, go to politicallynb.substack.com or patreon.com/politicallynb. But I would prefer everyone to be on Substack so that everyone can be in one place. So politicallynb, the letters nb.substack.com. Or you can, you know, support the podcast by telling people about it. That would be really great. Just tell people about the podcast, spread it on social media, rate, review, subscribe, all that jazz, and enjoy my episode with my libertarian brother.
This is Zach with the Texas Yurt Company, a proud sponsor of Politically Non-Binary. Don't know what a yurt is? Check us out online at www.texasyurts.com.
People have been saying that they're socially liberal and fiscally conservative or whatever, that kind of thing forever, though. Like, that's such a, like,
yeah,
that's almost a cliche.
It has become a cliche, but I think even a lot of people who say that don't really mean it. And
sure.
I mean, it's hard to know exactly what people... So, I think I mentioned to you that within the Libertarian Party, mm-hmm. there has been kind of a civil war that's been going on for the last 5 years. And the people that I'm a little bit more aligned with have come out on top of this. And it has been about this question of, is the pitch, you know, socially liberal and fiscally conservative, or is the pitch decentralize everything and let people live their own lives? And so there are libertarians who would argue and say, no, the point of libertarianism is to say, hey, let's be fiscally sane. Let's, you know, not be crazy with money. But then, you know, let's what we need to have is laws that put in place socially liberal values. OK, and so there's others who would say, no, your social views have nothing to do with it. All we're saying is you can't use the force of government to enforce your social views. Those right. are two very, very different approaches to libertarianism. So you could have somebody who's super, super, super conservative and he's like, look, I live my life this way. I will try to explain to you why I think this is the way to live. But I don't want to use the force of the state right. to make you live this way. So it's like, OK, that's still libertarian. Where there's others who would say, no, if you're not on board with abortions, if you're not on board with gay rights, if you're not on board with trans rights, if you're not on board with all these things, that's not libertarian. And so, like I said, there's been kind of this this battle over this question. Like I said, I call it the, are you going to go more the Ron Paul route or more the Gary Johnson route?
Are you saying that some people are saying, like, let's use the government to force liberty on people?
Okay, but again, it's force liberty, but that's one way of looking at it. There's some who would say, okay, although I've had that, you know, I've seen that where people will say, okay, you know, can you force liberty on
free, whether you like it or not?
Well, but again, it's a question of, okay, this would actually be a really interesting question for you. Would you rather have an empire that guarantees every civil liberty that you cares about, that you care about, uh-huh. but it's top down? It's absolutely a totalitarian empire, but you get every single civil liberty that you care about.
Okay.
All of them, like even the ones I haven't even thought of. Okay.
Yeah.
Get all of those, or would you rather have self-government?
I'm trying to imagine what that would be like to have an authoritarian government that gives every civil liberty that I want.
Okay.
Like,
it's hard to imagine. I understand that, but I'm just saying, you know, like here's another thing to kind of like think about. People use the word, just like people use the word conservative very differently. They use the word liberal very differently.
Right.
They use the word liberty very differently. The things that people believe in as being civil liberties, as being human rights, people can believe in some very different. So people will use the word freedom very differently. They'll right. say, okay, you know, you have like certain people believe in individual rights, but then there's others who believe in the rights of a collective, of a society. You know, you can kind of get into this whole notion of positive and negative rights and everything. I definitely have, you know, an opinion. I'm in a certain camp on that question, but I've become very aware that like even people will, sometimes you might even just say it's rhetorical that like, yeah, they're going to use the rhetoric of freedom no matter what position they're trying to advance. I don't know if you saw recently, a few days ago, there was a commercial that Gavin Newsom from California did, attacking Ron DeSantis in Florida and saying, hey, you know, they don't have all these freedoms over in Florida that we definitely respect over here in California. And I was like, oh, that's fascinating.
Because California is more free than
Florida. He was making, that is his pitch. He was making the pitch that, hey, California is more free because you have the freedom to do certain things that Florida is not so keen on at the moment. And again, but both of these societies would say, no, ours is the more free one because we let you do these things that are important and we're preventing these other things. And again, goes back to the question of, do you want something that guarantees the rights to do the things that you care about, or do you want to self-govern? Those are two very different approaches
I mean, part of the issue is that you say a government that guarantees all the rights that I care about, but it's like, so it's just the ones I care about? Like,
maybe you can tell them the ones that you don't care. Like, I'm just saying, if you could build an empire where you say, this is Ariel's empire, but you don't get to be the ruler, by the way. You have to be a subject
that's living under this empire.
Well, but yeah. I mean, there's one of the accusation that I see. I think it's funny because it's true. People who like staunchly advocate for, let's say, capitalism or socialism, the other side accuses them of saying, oh, but you assume that you're going to be a millionaire in that. Or that, you know, if you're the socialist, like you assume you're going to be the party boss. And like in reality, you're going to be the guy probably in the field working that, you know, that it's just kind of, okay, so if you could be a citizen of an empire that guarantees the things, that checks all the boxes for the stuff you want, and or would you rather have a self-governing society where people have to, you know, look after themselves and like you don't have necessarily positive rights. You have negative rights that where it's the rules are the government can't do certain things to you, but you have to make your own choices and have to live your own, you know. And so this is a thing that, you know, people have kind of like wondered about a lot. But there's a lot of people that will definitely use the language of, okay, yeah, but this is about freedom and human rights and these other things because, you know, you need a certain amount of economic prosperity to be able to pursue things. So that's why they'll say, hey, you need, you know, to make you free, we have to liberate you from bad material conditions. We have to liberate you from all these other things. But then it kind of comes to like, well, wait a minute. But in order to do that, aren't you taking stuff away from other people? And so isn't that going against freedom? So again, people will have this idea of freedom means, you know, some very different things to different people. I have seen people try to map this out culturally with as far as different groups we have in the United States and how the kinds of things that, say, Puritan societies in New England would have said, oh, yeah, but this is about freedom and human rights, are very different from the ones that people in the Midwest or people in the South or people in the West Coast, that kind of thing, you know, that like their notions of, OK, so what makes, you know, what are the human freedoms that need to be guaranteed, or what are the, you know, what do human rights actually mean? I can tell you where I come from on this thing. I can't speak for anybody else. I am someone who's definitely going down the path of, I think, anything that we can say as a right is a property right. And it comes down to the idea of self-ownership. You own your body, you own your mind, you own your thoughts, you own your labor, you know, you own the things that you do.
Yeah.
So human rights are things that you can do on a desert island without interfering with anybody else's thing. And so the idea of a right to healthcare or a right to a job or something like that, it's like, well, okay, but somebody has to provide for you, provide that for you. And unless you're willing to enslave somebody to say, hey, you must provide the healthcare, or you must provide the, you know, the whatever the thing is, positive rights for me don't work.
I think it makes sense to call universal healthcare a right, like, because of that, because it's like, how does that even function?
It is a commodity that I think is highly desirable. I want it to be as cheap as possible. Yeah. I want it to be as accessible as possible. That's a different conversation. But like,
or I think there can be a nationalized system.
I think there's ways to try to make that work. And I think that there's some people who have had somewhat successful, some more than others, versions of doing this. But my point is that I'm saying calling something a human right doesn't magically like make it so scarcity doesn't affect that thing.
Yeah.
Because, you know, yeah, there's only so much resources of certain things at a given moment.
Well, that's
that is constantly changing.
When we talk about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, we have to have these kind of like vague, amorphous, you know, but ones that like, yeah, desert island kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Like those, that's why we call those inalienable rights. Universal healthcare doesn't make sense because other people have to provide that for you. And it's like, what does healthcare even mean? Healthcare has meant so many different things throughout history.
I laugh at people who like talk about you know, health insurance as if that's the same thing as healthcare. And I'm like, oh, those are two very, very different things.
Well, yeah.
But
universal health insurance is a human right.
And it's like, okay, sure. So everybody can have insurance, but do you have enough doctors to provide the things that you're wanting to provide? No. Okay. Well, there's going to be a system of rationing then.
Right.
Is it going to be a centrally planned system of rationing where somebody is going to make decisions regarding what you can and can't do? Or are you going to have it be a pure market thing where it's literally based on prices and that kind of stuff? You know, like, what's the way you're going to do this? So, long story short, you know, for anybody who doesn't mean, hi, I'm Joel. I'm Ariel's brother. We're, you know, hanging out together. And I'm probably the crazy libertarian in the family. And I'm definitely approaching it. So my trajectory, I started out probably as someone who was like a rah-rah America, you know, patriot type. I joined the army. I did all that stuff. I went down the road, though, of eventually becoming a paleo conservative, which is like the old right before the neocons even existed. The old right was definitely not into foreign interventions. It was kind of the America first thing of like, let's take care of our own. We're not going to worry about the rest of the world, that kind of stuff. And I think there's some merit to
When you say America first, I just want to say, like, you would also say like that everybody else would also be like their country first.
Correct.
It's more like make your bed first.
Correct.
Kind of thing. It's not that you're saying Americans are the best and fuck everyone else.
Well, I mean, it's I probably was saying that to some extent.
Well, yeah, like, but
rah, rah, America's the best. Okay, so I have come out of that, though. Again, my stepping stone was I went from being a neocon who loved the American Empire.
Gross.
And was just like rah, rah. No, I'm serious, though.
No, I know, but gross.
You know, it's where I started.
Yeah. We've all had embarrassing pasts. Or
about 2006, so after voting for Bush twice, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I went down this paleocon route. So I was more of a constitutionalist and more of a, hey, you know, if I'm going to say I love America and I love the Constitution and I swore an oath to defend it and all this stuff, I was somebody who went down this path realizing that the Bush administration was full of crap.
Yeah.
And about various things. So I was somebody who
The Bush family is a...
Yeah, I don't like any politicians. Like, if we were to have discussions about politicians over the last 100 years, I think it's funny. Every time somebody says, we should impeach so-and-so, I'm like, well, we should have been impeaching people for about a century now.
Yeah.
Like, all of them.
And for the
like,
right reasons.
Correct.
Not for the blowjob reasons.
Not for maybe, the stupid reasons that,
maybe
like,
because they were selling our country
out. Well, because of abusing war powers.
Yeah.
Like, all of them for the last 100 years have been abusing war powers.
Exactly.
You can't do that. They're,
well,
like,
they clearly could.
I know, but, like, and this is actually the problem with constitutions as a whole. So, anyway, I'm just saying, I went down a constitutionalist route. I went down this kind of paleoconservative route. And then the more I read and the more I thought about things and the more I just wanted to be consistent, I was still a guy who was kind of pretty pro-free market, even as going down the paleocon route, even though the paleocons are a little bit protectionist. They're a little bit, the government needs to regulate things in order to, you know, protect Americans from the rest of the world. Anyway, so when I read that kind of stuff from, say, like Pat Buchanan or somebody, I, you know, was kind of like, oh, I don't know. But he would, you know, he would very much say, like, look, the free market guys are wrong and here's why, blah, blah. Well, I eventually, though, I came around to realizing I really am a free market purist, that I am someone who really does, like, in the vein of, say, like Ludwig von Mises, like classical liberalism in that sense, but that's what I really align myself with. I joke that maybe someday I'll become a Rothbardian. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
Not really.
Okay, that's fine. Hey, shout out to anybody who gets that reference. But yeah, I'm definitely a... So the proper term probably is what is called a minarchist, which means like absolute minimal...
When you start your period?
Pop.
Monarchy. That's when you start your
really?
Period. Yeah.
Okay, so in the political sense, it's actually, I think we get it from the Brits. A minarchist is somebody who believes in the absolute minimum...
Oh,
form
am
of
I anarchist?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
And like minimalist kind of thing?
I was spelling it with an E. Okay.
No. So a
minarchist.
Yeah.
Minarchist.
Minarchy is somebody who believes in the absolute minimum form of government. Now,
so not
crux,
anarchy, but
correct.
Minarchy.
Not anarchy, but just next to it.
Okay.
Like right next door.
Gotcha.
Okay.
So could we still have public libraries and fire people?
So I'll get to that question.
Okay.
The You know, the question about anarchy is funny because when I say, oh, maybe I'll become a Rothbardian someday, he was definitely an anarcho-capitalist. Okay. Okay? And that was his whole thing. Although he kind of regressed from that a little bit later on in his life. He wrote a lot of stuff, though, that's really interesting. But I definitely align myself more with a Misesian. My problems with anarchy, even though I understand where they're coming from and I understand the logic of the arguments that they can make, at least on the anarcho-capitalist side, the anarcho-communist side, I just shake my head at those guys. But anyway, I understand.
Anarcho-communism. It's funny.
No, there's people that, like, well, they will argue that in the 19th century, the original people to use the term anarchists were definitely arguing. They were arguing for, let's abolish the current order of things, anarchy in that sense, because we want to have communism. We want to have this other thing afterwards.
But that's a different order. That's not our anarchy.
Well, but the guys who started using the phrase, they were definitely in that camp. And so some of people who were like, no, in the absence of government, we're all just going to be super, super capitalist and super, super contractual.
Yeah.
And so, like, that's the ANCAP side of thing. Look, ANCOMs and ANCAPs will argue about who's the real anarchy. And there's some, it's not a binary. There's other positions in between those two camps.
Would you be an anarcho-communist if you were like saying we should be not have a centralized government, but just have smaller communities of people?
Not quite. I think that, you know, because look, there's a certain amount of, like, Marxian theory has this idea that eventually when you get to the point of, we've gotten rid of all the, you know, the things that we don't want, that eventually, like, we're going to go from having this totalitarian state, you know, managed by the dictatorship of the proletariat and everything, to eventually we're just going to abolish government because we don't need it anymore. Mm-hmm. And so there are Marxists who absolutely are like, you know, hey, this is what we're going to get to, is having no government. And everybody else looks at it and says, but what you're actually living, because you've never managed to get there, what you're actually having is, like, super, super, super government.
Right.
But there is some of the rhetoric of Marxism that is, we're going to get to the point where government becomes unnecessary.
Right.
I also am I would love to get to the point where government becomes unnecessary and where we evolve out of doing it. I just think we're going to get about it a very, 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 very different way if we get there, uh-huh. Which I'm not convinced of. I think, you know, things may not go the way I want to. As far as explaining where I live, you know, this is where NXP gets interesting, is people, you know, people have used the word anarchy to mean some very different things. Laura Ingalls Wilder, because I'm reading the books right now to my daughter, She called the American West slightly restrained anarchy in a positive sense. Like, she called it as in, like...
Oh, back in the day.
But what does she mean by that? Well, because you appoint a town sheriff.
Right.
And that's about it. So, and even then, that kind of decision is, like, super, super, super local.
Right.
But as long as you didn't have the feds bothering you, you really could kind of have whatever community you wanted to create, which...
Yeah, that's where I think I land, is, like, if we could get to a very local governance.
There is a strong American tradition of, hey, we got to, like, strike out into, like, where nobody is, and we got to, like, create our own thing. And now it's harder to do that because nowadays, like,
the land is filled in. You got to do it on the moon, yeah.
I know. And that's the hard thing. Like, where do you go to the frontier anymore? But there was definitely a long tradition.
Underseas. Of,
hey, we got to, like, strike out and build our own thing again because the stuff we're in right now sucks. And, you know, the Puritans did that. Mormons for sure did that.
Maybe we could take over Australia, clear that place out, and have a new...
It's older than that, too, though. I mean, the monastic movements of the Middle Ages were very much, we got to get away from this other stuff, we got to go and create our own community over here.
Either got to go out into space or
seasteading
underwater.
Is the other one I've seen, like, get out on the water.
Underwater.
The funniest one I saw as a manifestation, I don't know if you've heard of Liberland. There was... Somebody at some point a few years ago realized that in the maps between, what is it, like, Serbia and Croatia, I think. I might be getting this wrong, but I'm almost positive it's Serbia and Croatia. They realized that there was a gap in between where, like, they each were saying, no, the other guy's border stops here. And so there was, like, this thing of a few miles that, like, nobody's claiming it. Because Serbia's like, no, that belongs to Croatia. And, like, Croatia's like, no, that belongs to Serbia. And so we don't have anything there. So somebody just went there and said, okay, this is now the sovereign nation of Liberland.
It usually goes the other way, where people are saying we both own something. I've never heard of...
People aren't as... most countries aren't as interested in the expansionist, you know, wars and everything, because wars are expensive. Empire's expensive.
You take it.
Right. So this is that kind of thing. So to me, somebody just went and said, okay, well, so great. These, like, few square miles that we have, this is a sovereign entity. Mm-hmm. And, like, there's legit people who are saying, I'm going to immigrate there and I'm going to live. And because they're setting up we're going to have this country that has these rules and has this stuff, you know. And anyway, the crux of minarchy, getting back to that, is people then get into disagreements about, like, well, how minimalist are we talking? Mm-hmm. Like, are you talking American constitutionalism? Are you talking something a little bit more? Or like, where? And so, again, the distinction can get kind of gray sometimes as far as who's, you know, whether what you have is something that is functional anarchy, or whether it's something that is where everything's just very like contractual and agreed upon, or whether it's something that, yeah, you have a like really, 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 really small community that like elects a sheriff and has some kind of structure that way, but that's about all they do. I don't know. I'm interested in moving that direction. I think it's going to take more than my lifetime regardless. But another one too, that you might be surprised, J.R.R. Tolkien, mm-hmm. when asked about his politics. You know, and again, he's like a monarchist. He is like a straight up, I believe in the king and the traditions and all that stuff. But he said, actually, my opinions lean toward the anarchy. He's like, now, he knew that people were like going to think of the ANCOMs who were like, yeah, blow everything up and like, you got to start over and we're going to have communism. He's like, I don't mean whiskered men with bombs. Mm-hmm. I mean the abolition of centralized control.
Yeah.
Okay. And so, I mean, you know, you see this in his writings, his ideals, The Hobbit, The Shire. Yeah, what do they have? A small farming community that has a local sheriff, and that's about it.
Right, like the way that we make fun of England for having a monarchy now, and how kind of silly that is, even though it's largely
well, yeah, kind of we've made our royal family a bigger deal than they've made.
Well, theirs. Exactly. So I'm like, I think people are gonna like the way that we like laugh at them as if their king of queen system is any worse than what we've got going on in America now. Like, I think that eventually, if we figure this kind of stuff out, eventually people are going to look at all these centralized governments and go, centralized government.
This is kind of funny.
You let them have how much power?
Right.
Fools.
Pre-20th century, the English were still like, we have a king, but like, he's not actually part of our life. And the only like interaction you have with like the British government was like the post office.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And like, that was the kind of thing that Tolkien looked back nostalgically on. He's like, ah, this is like the life that, you know, again, you don't have to have anybody bothering you and everything. I mean, if you get into the Return of the King, you know, that when the hobbits come back and find the Shire has been like taken over, there's definitely some critiques of, wartime socialism as Tolkien perceived it, because he's like, yeah, I get it, we're fighting the Nazis, we're fighting totalitarian empire and everything, but he's like, wow, it seems like back home we've kind of turned into a lot of the same thing.
Right.
And so there's a lot of commentary in there about like, oh yeah, we're all sharing, we're all pulling together, and he's like, seems like there's a certain lot of us who do a lot of the sharing and the others who do a lot of the taking. Like,
yeah.
You know,
that always sneaks in with war.
Yeah. He has a lot of things to say about that. But I'm just saying that, you know, Wilder and Tolkien are definitely probably pretty darn socially conservative with their things. And again, talking about stuff like a monarchy, but, you know, they were people who talked about like, yeah, I'm kind of actually pretty close to anarchy. Mm-hmm. And there were, you know, people who still like, no, they believe in like custom and tradition, mm-hmm. but they didn't believe in like having a person over you who's the enforcer of that tradition.
Yeah. Bottom-up culture is better than top-down government. I think that's so
there's an argument that some people will say that actually, if we didn't have centralized control, if we let a lot of social institutions be organic,
right. That
actually you probably would have a lot of the country would be a lot more socially conservative, because again, a lot of those institutions that are older are going to have kind of norms that are, mm-hmm. you know, I think there's some merit to that. Maybe. I think you probably still have other people who innovate and come up with their own thing. I would argue though, for decentralization on a massive scale, and it's not just because, you know, to get what I want. It's also, again, there's people who have very different values from me that I wish them all the best, that they can go and try to live whatever cool thing they're going to do. If they want to implement some kind of, you know, socialized medicine on their, like, small commune, I think they have a better shot at it than doing it with 330 million people.
This is what I'm going to get to, is that I think America needs to decentralize. That's where I'm going to make this case that we need to massively, massively decentralize. And I have a few thoughts about how we can get there.
Okay.
So, are we back home?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So, I mentioned my trajectory. I went from being, you know, gross imperialist, nationalist, you know, to taking that nationalism and saying, no, but actually, the older conservative tradition was to be actually like, let's stay out of the world's affairs. Very Washingtonian in that sense of like, you know, don't mess with European wars, mm-hmm. don't mess with other people's stuff, and definitely don't build an empire elsewhere. you know, limited powers and everything. I went down the libertarian rabbit hole of like, okay, you know, if I actually believe in free markets and everything, like, okay, I think there's other ways of organizing things. So I will say, you know, as much admiration as I have for something like, say, the U.S. Constitution and what I think some of the founders were trying to do, I'm willing to move further down the freedom train than they were. Mm-hmm. Now you can say, well, how can that be? Well, okay, I mean, this is the one I've had arguments with my wife about, because she's definitely probably more of a constitutionalist, and she thinks it's a little bit scary to move past that. You know, but she'll agree with me on this point. Okay, so the Constitution authorizes a postal system. I absolutely think that there's can be better ways of doing deliveries. I think that FedEx, UPS, and Amazon and everybody else can do a better job of distributing physical media to people. And, like, I don't know that we need to have it be a thing that there's a U.S. postal system.
Right, because I know I've heard from some podcasts I listened to, I remember they were talking about how Amazon apparently has deals with the government.
Yeah.
So that they're getting their delivery done really cheaply, which is part of how they're able to undercut everybody else and have this. And so it's like we're paying through our taxes. We're paying for the shipping that we're getting for quote-unquote free from Amazon. So they can damn well deliver their own shit without government's help.
So, I mean, if you made me dictator of America where I got to do things, I would end, like, every subsidy to every entity ever. Like, all of them, it's just all gone.
No subsidies.
I would actually love to see what a real free market looks like in America, because we haven't had anything close to a free market. We've had, like, this mixed economy thing for a long time.
Real.
Unfortunately, there's a lot of people who look at that and say, oh, yeah, that's capitalism run amok. And I'm like, but there's other people who say, no, that's socialism run amok. I kind of side with, this is the thing that, like, Hayek and Mises got on, is they're like, that middle road where you try to have that mixed economy, you eventually still end up going towards socialism.
But what do we do about regulation situations? Because we need people to not overfish. We need people to not,
so you know, this goes on the whole,
those every, things that are like, the, yeah. What's the word
every for rights it? Is property rights, okay?
Yeah.
So, this is an interesting little tidbit of American history. What did you do about pollution before you had an EPA? What did you do about these things? And what would happen?
Well, before the EPA, we didn't have as polluting kind of stuff. I mean, with the
kidding? Coal burned crazy, like crazy. I mean,
when really was the disgusting. EPA?
That's in the 20th century.
Well, that's a long time. I'm just saying, like, technology has gotten increasingly.
I couldn't tell you the exact
there's
the
more
EPA
and more people using more and more polluting kind of technology. In the 70s? It might have been, but that's about that sounds about right. But either way, like you know, so we continue to burn more and more stuff.
It's interesting about this of like, what do you do about things like, you know, fishing rights?
Well, issues where the companies aren't being made to pay for what they're doing to our air, our water, our
a long time ago
resources.
They were.
In this what
is,
way?
No. So what would happen is, let's say you own a plot of land, okay? You're living on it. Somebody next door goes and builds a factory and it's blowing out disgusting smoke and it's like polluting the air on your land and everything. What they would do is they would actually then go and sue that person in court and they'd go before a judge and say, look, I have this nice land. They're making it dirty because they're dumping things in the water. They're putting stuff in the air. They're doing all this stuff. And for a long time, people successfully sued businesses, companies, and other entities that would go and do these kind of things all the time. Like they did it all the time and it won. And what happened is when World War I hit, when people, because of like the massive amount of like, hey, we got to make munitions, we got to make stuff to go and fight the war. Again, you want to talk about wars, distort and destroy everything. And World War I was so stupid. It had nothing to do with America. What happens is when they start having this war effort go on for World War I, the judges start looking at this stuff and say, oh, you know, yeah, I know that you're trying to sue the federal government for, you know, going and making war supplies and everything. And we need it so tough.
Yeah.
You don't get your mineral rights anymore. You don't get your water rights anymore. You don't get, you know, it's all, you don't get your clean air rights anymore. Like all this stuff that people had successfully, there was tons of precedent to go and say, oh, okay, here, you know, somebody's polluting this. And so you have to make them stop, you know, you have to order them to stop or they have to pay me damages for the fact that they're damaging what was otherwise clean property that was, you know, okay. And so I'm just saying like in the 20th century, we like reversed course on this. And so people didn't have this mechanism anymore to, deal with people who are polluting, people who are taking things like that.
Externalities. So, that's the negative. Yeah, the negative externalities.
And so I'm saying, like, I'm not arguing that it was perfect. There were plenty of flaws with 19th century America. I'm just saying that people did have a way of looking at this stuff through the lens of property rights.
Okay, but it's not just when one factory is polluting one person's property. It's like when they put lead in stuff. And so all these people, so we just have to do what, like a bunch of class action lawsuits. Then if you have class action lawsuits or lawsuits at all, you still need somebody who's...
Sure. And I mean, that's still how it works in power.
You know? Well, that's the government, right? So like, how do you have that? I mean, you could just have it on smaller scales. Like, I don't understand how we're going to have it if we want there to be able to be these big companies who do large scale things. We're still going to need, if people are going to sue, then there needs to be a government in place for who is the judges.
And you're wanting to have a referee, and this is something
referee.
That,
like, sure.
Okay. So, and this is where I'm going to say, look, I make the distinction of, I want there for, you know, if I'm going to have a government, I want there basically to be a court system, and I want it to basically have some kind of defense force, not an empire to go and do stuff. Although the problem with small government is it always gets bigger because people come up with ideas and stuff they want to do with it. But I would be content with saying, okay, we're going to have some kind of basic, you know, maybe people will look like local sheriffs or that kind of thing. We can have some kind of defense force or militia system that we're going to have for in case, you know, we get invaded by somebody.
Yeah. How does the defense work if we get invaded by China or Russia or somebody?
Okay. So I'll get into that.
Okay.
You know, defense, there's a lot of people who have written about how you could have privatized defense and you could have privatized police and you could have privatized. I am willing to say for now, I'm willing to table that for now and say, look, I'm willing to have collectivized defense until, you know, but I think if we get to the point, you know, this is a pipe dream. If we get to the point where we say, okay, we've managed to get rid of everything else. Like we have a really small government now. And so there's not much corruption going on because we've managed to get rid of everything else. I mean, we've even privatized the fire department, which I think is totally possible. I think you absolutely could have an insurance system based with companies that can do the fire department job. And they probably could have it, you know, work better than what we have right now. You know, the postal system's been dealt with, like everything's been dealt with, you know, if we get to that point where all that's left is we have a court system and we have a defense system that's still collectivist.
Yeah.
I'm still willing to have the conversation to say, is there a way we can move this forward? But I would be okay with saying, you know what? I'm content. We don't need to do anymore, guys. And so that's minarchy. That's me saying minimum. But I'm just telling you, there are people that have written tons of books about this, arguing about how you could have contractual services provided by basically, you know, like the equivalent of insurance companies and that kind of thing. And that even justice itself is something that you could have privatized judges that, you know, basically when two parties have a dispute, they can call on somebody to say, okay, you're going to be the judge.
We have arbitrators now.
Essentially, that's what it would look a lot more like. And so I'm just saying there are a whole bunch of people who have written a whole bunch of books about this. My issue with it is I think that a lot of this anarchy stuff sounds really nice in theory. I think a lot of it is very hard to put into practice, or it's going to take us a really long time to get there. I think that if some of it is too much like a philosophy class, I think going into, okay, but how do human societies actually work and how do people actually act? I don't know that every anarchist has really taken into account the fact that how people conceptualize things is highly cultural. You know, here's one of those little interesting things about the American Revolution. Mm-hmm. Yes, some of the colonists had read John Locke. Yes, some of them had read some of these different philosophers. But there's a whole bunch of them who are like, no, I just want the ancient rights of Englishmen, because they're like, the social contract was written up, or not written up, it was understood through tradition and precedent for hundreds of years to have certain things. Yeah, since Magna Carta and on, that you have, you know, that people have certain rights and that, like, it's just traditionally understood. It's always been this way. So, of course, that's what we have. And so when you have the parliament saying, well, no, but, you know, I have altered the deal. Pray I don't alter it further.
Yeah.
They're like, that's not what we... You know, that's not what has happened here. And so it's interesting because what they really weren't arguing for wasn't no taxation without representation. It's more like no legislation without representation. Right. They're saying you don't get to set rules for us. We're going to be self-governing here. Yes, we're going to notionally be tied to the monarch. Yes, we're, you know, they were willing to say, okay, sure, the king can be our sovereign and everything, but we're going to self-govern because that's what we've been doing for a long time.
Right.
And also the ancient rights of Englishmen, the older system of it, there were a whole bunch of things that were just understood because they'd always been that way. Which, you know, goes back to Tolkien. He's like, yeah, custom and tradition is what's going to rule things. You don't need to have people who are in charge, so to speak. So, you know, like I said, it's interesting that a lot of them, yes, some of them had read some of the philosophers, but the stuff that really sparked off the American Revolution was less to do with the theories of Thomas Jefferson and Thomas Paine. It was more to do with the fact that people were like, you changed the deal. Like, yeah. The deal was that we get these things and you leave us alone about that, and we pay you some amount of taxes, but not what you're currently going for. Yeah. Now, I mean, some of this sounds laughable because, like, the tax situation is, like, way grosser now than it ever was with the colonists.
It strikes me that no representation or no legislation without representation. Like, we are not really represented in this country.
We're not
anymore.
Okay, so there's my other point of
we don't get to why we don't have direct ballots very often at all, and so, no one feels represented by these jackals.
And there's a reason why. I will tell you. So again, why do I make the pitch for stuff like Constitution? I think because it's in the American cultural DNA, and people at least kind of understand.
When
like
we
that
talk about
this idea,
customs and traditions, the thing about it is America is a place with so many different ethnicities, religions, cultures.
It
so
absolutely
how
is.
How we can all agree, like take a, you know, especially in larger cities,
so
we're going to be able to agree on customs and traditions.
This is where, so the only way to make America work.
New religion.
We kind of had this idea that we have this like civic religion where we all kind of respect certain things, but that's breaking down.
Yeah.
I think a lot of the reason why we really got to telling ourselves that we're one people probably has to do with the aftermath of the U.S. Civil War and has to do with especially the aftermath of World War II, where we, you know, came together and we're like, oh yeah, we're the American people. And so people have this idea of there being American culture, but there's somebody who not that long ago wrote a thing talking about how like there's really like 11 or 12 Americas.
Yeah.
And like there are like these regional differences.
I've seen the regional map.
That we're all like this idea that we're one people. So, okay, here's, you know, this might make you laugh or might make you roll your eyes. And I think my 20-year-old self, who was very much the rah-rah America guy, would be a little bit shocked if I could go back and tell him, hey, by the way, I don't even like saying the Pledge of Allegiance.
Yeah.
Okay. And he'd be like, why? That's, you know, and I still know like people who are consider themselves to be conservative or consider themselves to even be originalists as far as how they understand the Constitution, who would be shocked at that. And some people get into arguments about whether the phrase, you know, under God applies and everything. And,
right,
because you
know, that was
how
added
appropriate
in the 40s
is that?
Or
correct.
Something.
But Francis Bellamy, the guy who wrote the pledge, was like a Christian socialist. And part of his whole thing was this idea of we're like speaking into existence, this idea of it being one nation, indivisible.
Right.
And I'm like, no, it's highly divisible. It is highly, highly divisible. It has
Most
always been that
way. Most things are divisible.
Yeah.
Even the atom turns
so
out to be divisible.
I'm
going to
get into, we don't feel represented. Well, there's a reason for that. Once upon a time, when the United States was forming, the population back then was about the size of Alabama.
Right.
It is today. Okay. And they could break that into 13 different things because they're all coming from these different colonies and they had these different traditions. And yeah, they were coming from different places, had different cultures, different religions. Honestly, all they really needed was just a mutual defense compact. There were a lot of them at the ratification debates and the constitutional conventions originally who were like, I don't know if this is going to work. We have really, really, really different values and we have really, really, really different customs. Even though, yes, a lot of us are Anglo-somethings, but we still have, like, different religions. We have different takes on things.
Yeah.
We have different cultures. There were a lot of them who were like, I don't know that this is going to work. Maybe we should just all go our separate ways. But there were others who were like, look, but there's a thing called the British Navy.
We need to defend ourselves.
We need ourselves against the British Navy.
Yeah.
They, you know, look, they're going to be able to pummel us if we don't stand together on this. And so, out of that kind of self-interest, there were a lot of them who eventually said, okay, fine. We'll be together. But, you know, they were still trying to...
For just a couple of purposes, but we want a very weak federal government.
In that time period, when they formed that, the ratio of citizens to representatives in Congress, you had about 30 to 40,000 citizens per one representative in Congress.
Yeah.
Okay. And at that time, they're like, okay, and this still might be too big,
right,
but for just for the most general of purposes, hence
right,
why they didn't call it the federal government, they called it the general government.
Mm.
For the most general of purposes, meaning the only things that these people are going to touch on is, hey, this United States, it's going to be a free trade zone. We're going to trade amongst ourselves.
Yeah.
We're also going to have it be understood that we have a common currency, not because the government is issuing it, but because we're going to say, look, a dollar is like, or $20 is like an ounce of gold, I think was the standard for a really long time. So they were just saying, we're going to set a unifying measurement to make commerce easier. We're going to have a free trade zone amongst ourselves. And we're going to have a common defense pact that we're going to defend each other if something comes up. And like, honestly, you could have written the Constitution where it just says that.
Right. That seems better.
That's it. And you just say, okay, and everything else, every social question, everything else is just left to the states. Or to the territories or to the, you know, whatever's that like, it's going to be, or it, I think the phrasing from the Ninth Amendment was like that these things are like reserved to the states or to the people. The Ninth and Tenth Amendment get into that stuff. And so it was just understood there's certain areas that like the feds are not going to touch. Okay. So they have like this ratio of saying, okay, but just for purposes of commerce and defense questions that are going to come up between these colonies, then states, we're going to have these people who are there. And originally they didn't even get a salary. And so they had a hard time getting them to even show up. But like, that was the original thing is like, we're just going to have these people who go and represent you. And the fact that it was relatively small meant that you had a reasonable chance of actually running into this person in your community and talking to them and being able to influence them and everything. Okay. Nowadays the ratio is we have about 700,000 people to every one representative. You don't have a snowball's chance in hell of influencing your person.
Right.
And so that's why we have this. So here's my argument. America's too big.
Yeah.
It's, this is not workable to have something that is this big. I'm not saying we need to have a bloody civil war. I'm not saying we need to have
a horrible conflict. America can, just smaller but if we kill each other.
So if, no, we don't have to make it smaller in the sense of
I'm kidding.
Killing each other. We, what we need is to decentralize. If we still want to be this United States of America and fly the 50 stars, we've got to massively decentralize in the sense of bringing back what is called federalism, which is a tricky subject because the ones who wanted to let, like, the people who called themselves federalists back in the old days were actually nationalists. They weren't federalists. Okay. The guys who called themselves anti-federalists were actually arguing for real federalism. They were saying,
what is real federalism?
Real federalism, TM, is the idea that, okay, you're only going to have a very, very few specific enumerated powers for that federal government to do. Again, touching on, okay, there are questions of, you know,
currency and defense.
Yeah, commerce and defense. And that's all they're going to touch on. Everything else is going to be left to the people in their communities, in their states. And like this idea that you're going to have the feds ever come and tell a state, no, you can't do that, was absurd. James Madison argued for the federal negative over the states, and he didn't get it. Like in the ratifications debate, he argued for that, and it was soundly rejected. There was one of the founding fathers who said that idea should damn the Constitution. That, like, absolutely not. The states are sovereign. You know, no, you do not get to have the feds telling. So this
like
is
we just got rid of
We just got rid of the empire. We're not having. We're not turning this into an empire. Now, Alexander Hamilton was the type who was saying we're eventually going to get to an empire anyway. Let's just go ahead and do this. But this gets back to the question. Basically. Do we want self-government or do we want to have the empire that says, no, but we're going to guarantee the things that you want?
How do you think if it hadn't been for federal intervention, how do you think slavery would have? I think it would have eventually been phased out.
And this is one of those. This is probably one of the trickier things. It's a thing. I think it would have been phased out. I think there's every reason.
Because all the other countries were phasing it out, too.
Brazil, just phased it out non-violently. They just, you know, eventually voted it out. It took them a little bit longer, but they were able to do it without that. Missouri, who stayed Union side during the Civil War, but was still a slave state before the 13th Amendment was ratified, but after the Emancipation Proclamation had been issued, they on the state level, like in that time, they came together and voted on it and they got rid of slavery in Missouri. Okay.
I mean, you can't really look at that because the Civil War is already.
I know. But I mean, the Civil War is a little bit tricky actually because, I mean, the mythology that we got when we were kids was that like the North was like, oh yeah, we got to like go fight this war to go and free the slaves. Whereas in actuality,
It was a power struggle.
It was a power struggle, and there's a reason that they were fighting over slavery, but over different aspects of it than people think they were. It's not that the North was a bunch of abolitionists. It was that they didn't want the voting blocks that were popping up in the West as it would be as being settled to be on the side of the slave states because they wanted allies. You know, so there's things having to do with the politics of it. But the thing is, Kentucky, Delaware, and New Jersey were slave states that stayed in Missouri. Were slave states that stayed on the Union side.
Yeah.
When the Emancipation Proclamation was issued, they weren't included.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it was only
the ones that were in rebellion because the intent of it. Because look, as the executive, Abraham Lincoln doesn't have the authority to do that. It has to happen through a constitutional amendment. You know, the 13th Amendment is the thing that actually ended slavery. So, and there's a whole bunch of things Abraham Lincoln did during that war that it's like, okay, you don't have the power to do that, but he got away with it because he won.
Right.
Anyway. Those states still had slavery. Missouri decided to get rid of it on their own. Good for them. Delaware, Kentucky, and
New Jersey
didn't get rid of it until the passing of the 13th Amendment. And they voted against the passing of the 13th Amendment. So It's not like they were like, oh, yeah, I guess it's time to go. No, they're like, no, we're not doing this. Yeah. Okay. They lost. Okay. So I would argue, yes, I think communities would have gotten rid of it on their own. I think it was becoming more and more obvious that it was an outdated custom, that in the face of things industrializing,
was it wasn't an efficient way to do it. Between industrialization and general, like, universal moral
things were
progress,
changing.
Because around the world, countries have been getting rid of slavery.
Although,
so eventually, it would have been too embarrassing.
There's still places that haven't.
There are, yeah, but in terms of the larger Western empires, it would have become just too embarrassing to continue.
This is one of those weird things that, like, look, can you count?
Morally disgusting.
Here is the moral temptation, I think, is you can look at that and say, great, yeah, see, look, the British Empire abolished slavery through straight up imperialism in a lot of places that did that. I'm glad they did that, given the conditions that were there. But isn't that the temptation of empires? Hey, we just got to take the power and then we can do the good thing. We can do the good thing that we want. And that is a really, really tempting thing. I mean, you remember in Lord of the Rings where, like, Frodo offers Galadriel the ring and she's like, you know, I admit it, I've kind of wanted this. And she's like, yeah, I could. And in the book, Sam is like, yeah, she'll set things to rights. Like, yeah, give her the ring. You know, it's the question of, okay, who can we actually trust with power? And if you remember, this is one of the reasons why I love that story. I mean, I loved it because I loved medieval things as a kid, but the story is really about the dangers of power and what it does even to good people.
Right.
Frodo, who's like about as good and innocent and pure as you can get, is destroyed by it. You know, he never recovers really from having had that take its toll on him. People are very much tempted by the idea of like, oh, hey, but with, you know, with the power, then I can set things right. I can do things like end slavery. Okay, except notice they really didn't.
You know?
And it's one of those things that we've had this fiction of like, oh yeah, the war was about slavery and that there's one side that is wanting to abolish and the other one is saying, look, we know we have our weird social custom, but it's ours and stop it. We're going to self-govern. Mm-hmm. The other thing I will tell you about is, again, a lot of people don't know, I'm not making apologies for the Confederacy. They were messed up in all kinds of ways. But when they saw that they were having manpower issues with having to fight the Northern invasion, the discussion of maybe we should free the slaves and arm them.
Yeah.
It got talked about. Like it was definitely on the table. And so the fact that it was on the table tells me, okay, I think it was like phasing out. There were already people in the South, in the antebellum period who were talking about like, we got to find some way to deal with this issue. Even some of the founding fathers were like, yeah, we know this is wrong.
Right.
We just don't know how to quite get out of it because you're talking about a massive
economic.
It's an upheaval and everything. And people are scared of that.
Yeah.
So, you know,
you're saying people would eventually get to a lot of the right places themselves.
I think it's
better if you let them do it in a self-governing way.
Well, because I think what you could have had is when you let them do it in a self-governing way, I think you're going to have a lot less bloody of a time trying to do it because, you know, what happens, even when you make somebody do the right thing, if you push them to it, get ready to have the guerrilla campaign of, you know, the people resisting and everything and, you know, get ready to have the
That's
people fighting
back.
That's what
I try to tell the trans rights fighters all the time. It's like, you got to win hearts and minds the way gay people did.
Yeah.
Not this kind of totalitarian way of...
If it's done through imposition, people are going to resist.
People are going to resent
it. If it's done through persuasion...
Push the pendulum farther and farther back.
If it's done through persuasion, I think you'll make a lot more...
Obviously, it's been quite a while and the race situation in this country is still, you know, so fucked up.
But it is, like, but you know what's weird about that is I swear when we were little kids, we had like this little moment of where we got into post-racial stuff.
I thought the same thing. It could just be because we're from Houston.
Houston was very cosmopolitan in the South. It's true.
It could be that things are more visible with social. Yeah. But I still think there was a period where even there's still like messed up things were happening. There was still, I'm not saying that racism was gone, but it did feel like we were making a sort of progress in the 90s and early 2000s.
It did. In the 80s and 90s, it feels like we made a lot of progress in the 80s and 90s that it feels like, I will tell you, it was shocking to me. When I went to boot camp back in 2004, I remember it was fascinating to me because growing up in Houston, it was like, yeah, it's the South, but it's like super cosmopolitan because it's an oil city. And so there's business
it's extremely
everywhere.
Diverse. Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally,
it's like super diverse
and international place.
Yep. And so I remember meeting a guy who was from the backwoods of Arkansas.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, he said the phrase, I hate N-words.
Right.
And I was like,
oh, I didn't.
You exist? This is,
yeah, exactly. We didn't know. Like, that, I didn't know that existed in Houston. Once we moved to Richmond Rosenberg.
Well, but I'm saying I didn't meet him in Houston. I met him in like, you know, I was Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri, or Fort Lost
Arkansas and Missouri and Mississippi.
It was interesting to me to see that. It's like, wow, this still exists. I didn't think we had. And every now and then I'd see little snippets saying, okay, there's still that. But as far as I think a lot of progress was made. I think there's people who wanted to profit out of regressing into tension again, and so they've been fomenting that kind of stuff for a long time. I definitely, though, even though it felt like we made a lot of progress in the 80s and 90s, I can tell you I had teachers in middle school and high school because we lived in A-Leaf, which was like highly, highly black.
Yeah.
There were definitely people who I could see that if we were to call them nowadays, I'd call them SJWs, or I'd say that, you know, they definitely seemed like they were still trying to push those things. And I was like, oh, this is interesting. Hmm. But there's one of them who was like, well, you know, because she wanted to, like, I had an English teacher who wanted to make, like, every assignment needed to be about writing about racial conflict and racial tension and everything. And I was like, so I'm the white guy.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have the experience necessarily of having been black that I can, like, speak to. I mean, I can speak to it, like, an academic sense.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, well, but I mean, at the same time, she's like, okay, but you've noticed you're, like, you know, one out of a handful of white kids in this very, like, all the middle school is super
Anglo,
black.
Can I just say Anglo, by the way?
Yeah, that's fine.
I just
it's probably a better descriptor.
I prefer that because archetypally, it's just really fucked up to me to do white.
Her word, though, I think she's like, you know, it's
I'm
the,
sure
the white
everyone
kid.
Does. I'm just trying to move away from
and
that.
That's, so, that's totally fine. Yeah. Although, I mean, that's very like British Isles centric kind of thing.
Yeah, or, you know, European heritage.
Yeah, Western European.
I call us wheat because that way it's it's more descriptive. It's more accurate. And
I did the DNA test, so I saw a smattering of like the different things that were there.
Yeah, for sure.
Honestly, we're more Nordic than anything else.
Sure, but I'm just saying, if you're doing colors, let's call it wheat instead.
Yeah, so anyway, but she was like, you know, so you're like the one Caucasian kid in like this school, or not one, but a handful of Caucasian kids in the school that was predominantly black. And she's like, but this is actually a fascinating experience for you to be the like numerical minority.
Right.
And she's like, don't forget what that's like when you like go live somewhere else that, you know, you're not in the numerical minority. I was like, I mean, I took that to heart. It's like, okay, you know, this is interesting to see what this is like being numerically the minority. But yeah, like even she, who was somebody who was sensitive to the fact that we had honest discussions about this.
Yeah.
And I don't think she hated me and I didn't hate her.
Yeah.
But she still, I could tell that like her life experience, she thought it was important to keep this memory alive of like what it was like to fight for civil rights and everything. But it seemed to me like some of the people who maybe wanted to keep the memory of this alive, then they were doing some damage by tearing open these wounds like constantly and like constantly telling everybody, hey, so there's this history of, you know, hatred and mistreatment and everything. And some of us would look at it and say, yeah, but I didn't do it. I wasn't alive then.
Yeah, sometimes, and it not just from all kinds of different races and ethnicities and social groups and, you know, gay, whatever, all the different kind of oppressed people. Sometimes it sounds to me like people are yelling, you hate us and we know it.
Yeah.
And it's like, no, we don't. There are some people. But
yeah,
like, and
there,
so the more that you sit there and yell, I know you hate us. I know you secretly hate us. I know that you guys all, when you're in private, you hate us. And I do think that, because it's like, it's important to be able to discuss historical issues. It's important to be able to discuss the realities, because like you and I, with all the privileges that we have, still don't see all the stuff and we don't experience all the stuff that some people are experiencing.
Do you know what's funny though about growing up where we did? Another thing that like, Texas is funny like this because Texas was totally part of the Confederacy.
Yeah.
It absolutely had the same problems that Confederacy did. It absolutely had slavery. It absolutely had all the like real problems that the American South had back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But did you ever notice growing up, Texans didn't get waxed nostalgic for the Confederacy?
Yeah, no.
They waxed nostalgic for the Republic of Texas.
Yeah.
So when they're feeling kind of independent and they kind of feel like they want to be their own thing again and, mm-hmm. you know, say, kiss off to, you know, F you to the feds. They talk about like, oh, we should be the Republic of Texas again. They never talk about
Confederacy.
Like, let's bring out the, you know, the Confederate battle flag. Nope.
Yeah.
Never happened.
It's a little dorky for Texas.
It's fascinating because the Republic of Texas totally had slavery. It totally had all the same problems, but nobody nowadays associates it with that. And so you can have this whole, like, let's be independent, let's be Texans. And like everybody gets pulled into that regardless of race. It really does become like a, like you're part of the state, and so you get to be part of this thing, and we don't care about the racial aspects of it anymore, even though like they totally had the same racial problems back then.
Yeah, we welcome all the Texans.
So I think there's some people who wish it were the same way for talking about the Confederacy that say, okay, forget all the racial stuff. Like, we just want to be a, you know, an independent entity again. But everybody does this, oh, okay, yeah, because you want to bring back like horrible racial things. And they're like, no, I don't. I want it to be this other thing. And I was like, it's fascinating that Texans like got away with it. Mm-hmm. The rest of the South did
not. A little bit. I mean, people still, Yankees and people still have that kind of knee-jerk reaction that Texas is this horrible.
That's probably true. But as far as like how we looked at ourselves, like, you know, it's fascinating that like Texans kind of got by on this whole, like, yeah, we're independent because we're the Lone Star State. I miss it. I confess, I miss it. And honestly, if I were to move to Texas, I probably would be one of those guys pushing for Texas secession. I will say, actually, the biggest problem with my position living where I do, because I'm in the Soviet Republic of Washington, is I absolutely think that America needs to decentralize. I think, and I have some ideas of how we get there. I think there's a nice way we get there, and I think there's an ugly way we get there. And there's a few other alternate versions in between. The problem I have is, let's say we decentralize and we get what I want. I think probably Washington State is going to go the direction I don't want them to, and I need to get out of here.
Yeah.
Because if I'm really, you know, if I were to be less hypocritical, I would say, okay, vote with your feet. Well, I need to move here. Well, but I have other things like family and stuff that are tying me here. And so it is harder. And so I recognize that is a hard thing. I'm just saying that as a general thing, though, I think it's easier to say I can move somewhere that is still sort of part of this thing that is more agreeable to me rather than I can leave the entire United States. Although don't think I haven't thought about that. Of like, if I had to leave America, where would I go?
Right.
Anyway, how do we get there as far as decentralizing? You know, I think as far as the American cultural institutions go, I think we can go towards saying things need to be done at the state level. The 10th Amendment Center, I'm kind of a fan of the work they do, and they'll go it, whether, you know, it's going into places that are big on gun rights and saying, yeah, you know, we should actually be pushing for this because it's a civil right. And, you know, you can get right wingers say, right, clearly the feds shouldn't be messing with this. Or, you know, whether it's gay rights or something in a more progressive area saying, hey, yeah, the government shouldn't have anything to do with this. You know, marijuana legalization was probably the biggest one that's fascinating to watch that people discovered nullification again to say, well, you know, what are they going to do? Send the troops in and like, but I think you could do that with all kinds of stuff. I told you, you're probably going to be surprised to hear the position I take on gun stuff. Cause okay, look, I'm probably the only one in the family that's a gun nut, but I am. I like guns. I like shooting as a sport. I think hunting is a perfectly fine sport to get into. I believe in just the whole idea of the citizen militia as far as armed citizens keeping tyrants at bay and everything. You know, I believe in that kind of stuff, whether you can say there's a certain amount of Anglo-American mythology built into that, maybe. But I'm a big fan of, say, like the groups like Black Guns Matter, who like are going into inner city areas and teaching people about gun rights and that stuff. Anyway, so I'm a big gun guy, but I think that the recent Supreme Court thing about how they did that was wrong.
Oh, really?
Yes. And this might surprise you because I should be the guy who's saying, no, yeah, like, you know, right, we should be able to have our guns everywhere because it says Second Amendment. We can't have that. All right. Here's the thing about the Bill of Rights.
Well, what did the Supreme Court do?
Oh, do we need to give context? Because maybe somebody listens. Okay. So we recently had the thing about New York Rifle and Pistol Association or whatever it's called, where, you know, New York notoriously has had restrictions on gun rights. Mm-hmm. Okay. And people who've lived there have complained about how hard it is to get a gun permit because, you know, the police have to issue you one. And wow, it's really weird that they seem to only issue them to like elites and to people who have connections and that kind of stuff. And there's been horrible cases that have been busted about like people who can bribe the police to give them a permit. But like the regular plebs can't have one.
Yeah.
So they heavily, heavily restrict gun permit access. Well, the Supreme Court said, no, you can't do that because, you know, it's part of the Bill of Rights, shall not be infringed. Mm-hmm. This is a constitutional right. All right. For someone who believes in the idea of the Constitution as a way to get to where we want to go, mm-hmm. because it's part of our American cultural tradition, you probably think that I'm cool with that. The problem I have with this, all right, this gets into what the Supreme Court is and does and what the Bill of Rights actually is and what was agreed upon when we do this, you know, when it was set up. Again, I said the feds don't get a negative on what the states do. I really like, so even something I care about, like mm-hmm. gun rights, I think actually no, but the proper way to get there is, you know, it has to be done organically from the bottom up. This is a top down imposition of saying, okay, American values beats New York values. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's hard for me to admit it, but to say this, but yeah, I think they were wrong in doing this. Same reason why, like, and this is where it gets really weird. The timing of this, you know, when people listen to this, we just had the Roe v. Wade thing overturned right. as well. And their whole logic for that is like, yeah, it has to go back to the states. The feds have nothing to do with this.
Yeah.
This is not a constitutional issue for the feds to address because it's not, you know, and I'm like, right, but neither is the other thing. How there was the argument when the Constitution was written, there were some people who were saying, no, we don't need to have a Bill of Rights because they're like, oh, don't worry. The feds are never going to do the things that they obviously are going to end up doing, which they did. Mm-hmm. But there's others who are like, no, we're only going to agree to this if we have a Bill of Rights that guarantees that they're not going to touch certain things. And the question of like, okay, but what about state sovereignty with it? That kind of stuff. Where does that come into it? It was understood, and this is what they agreed to. The Bill of Rights is a restriction on what the feds can do. It is mm-hmm. not a restriction on what the states can do, which is why states have their own constitutions. So that's how it was originally understood. After the 14th Amendment, we just kind of, with the incorporation doctrine is what it's called, that's when we just kind of decided, okay, well, yeah, it all applies to the states. And that is a very big violation of what was agreed to when the thing was drawn up. And again, it's not just what it was agreed to. This was talked about in the ratification debates. They absolutely talked about these scenarios of what if this happens. And there were agreements made that as soon as like the thing was signed, though, you had guys like Alexander Hamilton who were like, yeah, I know we said that, but we don't care. We're going to do what we want to, you know, mm-hmm. which is aggravating and infuriating. But, you know, you kind of wonder like, okay, was he being disingenuous the whole time he argued for, oh, don't worry, this is never going to happen. Mm-hmm. So anyway, the one of the things that, you know, an example of this of things, it's clearly in the federal constitution, but it didn't apply to the states. For a really long time, there were states that still had state churches. Mm-hmm. And it's like, oh, wait, but the First Amendment is there. Yeah, that means the feds can't set up a church. States still could because states can do what they want. For a long time, states and territories had gun restrictions. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't considered illegitimate because the feds aren't the ones doing that. That's the states doing that because that's the locality. Now, where would you get that tricky into that today? Well, again, there were some who argued we didn't need a Bill of Rights at all also because they're like, what, all the civil liberties and stuff that's already handled at the state level, that everybody's state constitution had those things spelled out. And so they're like, putting this in the federal thing, won't that give people the idea that the feds do have something to do with this? Mm-hmm. And so I kind of think, yeah, maybe we should have gone more that route of, look, the one I care about, like, you know, as the gun guy, mm-hmm. Most states have a Second Amendment kind of phrasing in their thing. Even Washington State, where I live, mm-hmm. has a thing about the right to bear arms. Now, not all states do. California does not, and Iowa does not. Mm. And so actually, according to how I'm looking at things, California can do whatever the heck they want as far as gun stuff, because it doesn't say in their constitution that people have a right to bear arms.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't say it at all. Yeah. And so what I would parse this and say, okay, the actual, if we were really following the Constitution, it would be, there's no National Firearms Act, like all the federal stuff, like no machine guns and no mm-hmm. suppressors and SBRs, all that stuff goes bye-bye. Like mm-hmm. all that goes bye-bye. And the feds have nothing to say on any of those questions, but then states would have their own things. The beauty of it, you know, where I live, Washington State says, hey, and it doesn't even say anything about a militia. It doesn't say anything about militia service. It says mm-hmm. the individual citizen mm-hmm. has the right to bear arms in self-defense and in defense of the, yeah. you know, the state, the community, all that stuff. So it says those, and I'm like, right, the individual. And so I wouldn't even have to make the argument like, well, you know, does this have anything to do with militia service?
Right.
It's super not ambiguous how it says right. it. Now, where's the problem that I run into? Well, I mean, Washington has these on their constitution, and they still you know, go and do these things anyway.
Yeah.
So what's my answer to that? Well, we would need to sue the crap out of them in state court.
Yeah.
Or here's where we get to it. We say, in the course of human events, when it becomes apparent that you can't be part of this, great. That's where we would have to say, great, I'm going to break away from this. We're going to declare independence. I think this is very possible. This is going to happen. Okay. So I'm a fan of let's decentralize, but we could also have, we straight up might have states that just say it has become self-evident that Washington, D.C. doesn't represent us. And they've got a really good case. Why do I say that?
Yeah.
It could be left of center people in California that say that. Mm. You could have CalExit. You could have Texit. You could have Texas people who are right of center who are saying, hey, it's become self-evident that Washington, D.C. doesn't represent us. So we're going to go our own and do our own thing. I think that's perfectly legitimate. I think they absolutely can do that. That is what was agreed upon at the constitutional conventions. And I will tell you, the Northeast thought about seceding several times before the Civil War happens because they didn't always like the things that were happening either. So to say, oh, yeah, secession is like not okay. Well, if secession is not okay, then the whole American Revolution isn't legitimate either because it was a secession movement. Like, I believe in self-governance. I believe in the idea of, you know, that people can... and I had an argument about this with a friend of mine because, you know, he was saying, like, you can't just be like, hey, I'm declaring myself independent for this. And he's like, you got to have a group of people. I'm like, how big does the group have to be before you can legitimately say, all right, we here in Pierce County, Washington, have decided that Washington doesn't represent us anymore. So therefore, we're going to be our own thing. I think we could have states secede from the union if they want to. I think there's a whole bunch of states that could break up into smaller chunks.
Mm-hmm.
Getting back to where I think we could probably have this go, are we 12 different Americas? Honestly, we're probably big enough to where we could have 12 different federated republics, each with like 30 of their own states. Some of those states are going to look like just cities or look like counties as we see them right now, but they're big enough now where they certainly could be their own things. They could have their own representatives. And I'm not saying, I'm not saying we need to have a civil war over this. I'm saying we can have an amicable resolution of these conflicts by saying, look, let's trade together. Let's have a military alliance if we still really want to, but we don't have to be part of the same polity. We don't have to have where we're at each other's throats constantly and where everything becomes this struggle to get 50% plus one to impose our will on other people. It's okay to just say, look, let other people be their other thing. Let California be California. Let New York be New York. So, you know.
Wait, so this would be like the United Regions of Ununited States.
Yeah, I don't think we are, you know, especially with the attempt to make us the United State. That is not working.
Yeah, okay? The United States.
The one nation indivisible does not work. Whether or not you want to say it's under God, that's up to you. But the United States does not work. I think the right step is to have us be the United States. And it's very, you know. As we do this, I mean, the other route we could go is a constitutional convention. We could have a convention of states. I think the other part that's really, really possible if we go to the convention of states idea and we say we're actually going to redraft a new constitution because clearly the social contract we have right now is not working. People are pissed off. I think it's very possible people will come to the idea that, like, we are so different now that we can't be part of the same polity, and an amicable divorce would be better than a civil war over this kind of stuff.
Couldn't we could look more like the European Union.
That's what the U.S. is supposed to be. It's supposed to be a confederation of micronations.
Right.
It's kind of funny because there's one of the guys I, you know, follow some of his stuff, whose name is Hans Hoppe, who was like, Europe would be better off as 1,000 Liechtensteins than as like one massive thing. And I'm like, right. America would be better off as 1,000 Rhode Islands than
Rhode Island, but yeah.
For size purposes.
Yeah, just for size. Yeah.
My point is small is beautiful.
Yeah.
I really think that you can have a small...
The more local the government is, the more representative it'll actually be.
I'm not saying that all problems go away. Obviously, there have been problems in certain areas. I'm just saying letting people resolve them themselves. And I mean, what if people kind of come to the conclusion, if you really come to the point where you're not going to convince somebody, don't people disassociate and say, great, I'm just not going to interact with that person anymore.
Right.
That would be more like, that sounds mean, like as far as canceling somebody, but isn't it better than shooting bullets at them?
Right.
Like, isn't it better than, you know, getting into blows over this stuff? Like, so I think that some of the founders who were like, I don't know that this is going to work. Maybe we do need to go our separate ways. They might have been right. I don't know how much the British Empire still would have mucked about with us. But it's, you know, it's hard to say. Even still, I think there are several points in American history where we could have, you know, Thomas Jefferson got into this, where he's like, you know, I think every couple generations we need to have a revolution.
Yeah.
I would say, yes, you're correct, Tom. It just doesn't need to be a bloody revolution.
Right.
It can be, we're just coming together and we're going to renegotiate the social contract.
You
if
know
we
those,
find that it doesn't work anymore, great. We're going to split
off. You know
off
those marriages where they say every 7 years or whatever, we're going to like review whether we still want to be married.
I've heard of that. Yeah.
Yeah. So maybe we could do that same thing and we can say, hey, let's review and see whether we still want the federal government to be like this, or maybe we redraw
some. You know, I mentioned Liechtenstein.
Yeah.
The guy who is the sovereign of there, they put that in their constitution that they like at any point can like depose him and like create a new thing, and he doesn't have to be their traditional like Prince Adam, I think is his name. Sounds like a man. But anyway, yeah, I think the route that we're going to, you know, I think there's ways that we can push in this direction. Now, the other problem I have is, as much as I'm like, yeah, I would need to leave the area I'm in because I suspect that Washington State might want to go a different direction
right.
than I want to live in. If, you know, we stop being Merca.
Maybe I'll come back to Texas.
Of America. Maybe I would. I wouldn't mind. If I had, I mean, we joked that if Texas seceded, we'd go back.
Sure.
Honestly, but is this stuff likely? Probably not. Me and the people I associate with in the wing of the Libertarian Party that I'm part of, you know, we are definitely trying to boost this signal as far as how this goes. But I mean, there's a reason why I collect guns and other things too. It's not just because I like this stuff. I think that conflict may come anyway.
Yeah.
Just because there are certain people that are so vested in the power that they have that I got to be ready to, you know, defend my community, my family, my loved ones, all these things. Because things might get really dicey. Or, you know, if we start having like real hunger and real
shortages. Well, that's
shortages,
the global financial meltdown,
yeah,
water
there's
shortages.
Gonna be some, there's going to be some issues like that that, we might just be rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic as it is right now.
Exactly.
No matter what ideas I have, it's very possible that we're already past the
tipping point.
And we're just waiting until the shooting starts. So I'm trying to secure things.
I hope not, but yeah.
Yeah, I hope I'm wrong, but I kind of wonder if that's like the direction we go. But the beauty of that would be if we are at that, that means that like it might actually go faster if we crash and rebuild than it would be if we like tried to do the legislative process of like, here, let me spend the next 50 years trying to like move us in this direction, even though I would prefer the peaceful route. But, you know, the silver lining would be is like, if we destroy things, that means that out of the ashes of that, we might be able to make something better, or at least something that's more reasonable. But I would say like, look, if we could have the amicable breakup, mm-hmm. if we could have that, I think we could like ease our way into it a little bit better than, I mean, or if we can actually manage to where we can apply real federalism again and actually have people say, look, the only things the feds touch are the most general of things. Everything else is done at your local level, at your state level, or what have you. We could maybe continue to be the United States of America. If we can't do that, an amicable breakup would be preferred and let us down easy and like, let's, you know, sort out who owns what in a civilized manner. That would be preferable. But, you know, if we get into the boogaloo, as it gets sometimes called on the internet, which I don't know if you know the origins of that. It's kind of funny.
Not really.
Yeah, the reason why it's called the boogaloo, there is an old, like, old movie that was, like, you know, in the era of, like, movies where, like, it's about, like, kids on the beach and dancing around, like, 60s movies, that kind of stuff. There was, like, a thing of something part two, electric boogaloo. And it was, boogaloo was like a dance and that kind of stuff. So people started jokingly referring to Civil War II, electric boogaloo. And so it took off from there as like a, okay, so saying, yeah, we're going to have like another civil war. And there's a lot of people who are like, you know, jokingly chomping at the bit for it. But there's plenty of people like me who are like, I actually don't want that. But in case it comes, I need to go ahead and make sure that I have food, weapons, and other things supplied so I can ride out the rough period.
Right.
It's not that I'm going to go seeking out like federal agents to go murder them. It's more like, look, if people come and mess with me and mine, I need to be prepared to, you know, defend this and everything. But what I'm going to say, though, is like, look, some people thought the Soviet empire would never end. It did. And a lot of those little former Soviet satellites are actually doing pretty good right now.
Yeah.
You know, they've kind of figured out this capitalism thing. They've kind of figured out how to make stuff work. And a lot of them, some of them are implementing ideas that are better than us. And it's kind of funny because I've heard from Czech people that they tell us that in the 80s, American culture was an inspiration to them. And I'm like, man, I wish we were as good as like what you thought
something
we were
to be
in the
inspiring. 80s. Yeah.
Right. I mean, same thing with Hong Kongers who are waving the American flag in opposition to the Chinese government and everything. And I'm like, man, I wish we were the America Hong Kong thinks we are.
Yeah, but we're still not the CCP.
Oh, I know. I know we're not. And I'm aware of that, but it's still the, I think that little places like that, you know, there are Czech Republic people now who, you know, or Estonians or Hungarians or others who were like, yeah, never again. And so they're implementing, I'm not going to say they're doing everything perfect, but they've implemented a lot of sensible policies and that kind of stuff as far as being fiscally sane mm-hmm. and that sort of thing. I think that we don't have to look at the end of America as being like, oh man, it's never going to be like good to live here again. No, there's plenty of, you know, all those ex-Soviet satellites had a really rough patch for a while.
Right.
Things got better.
Yeah.
And I think they're on a much more stable trajectory now than they were. I think the same thing can happen with the United States. After the dust settles, whether we do it amicably in a civilized way or whether we do it in a, well, some people got shot at way, which, again, I'm not advocating for that. I don't want that. I'm just trying to be prepared in case it comes to that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that the dust will settle and people will figure out how to resume doing normal things with each other and trading with each
yeah.
other and prospering together and, you know, building the things that they love and doing the things that they want.
The dust always settles.
It does. Like, the idea that, like, if civilization collapses, it's going to be Walking Dead forever. No, it's not.
Not even forever.
That show is fun silliness, but even then, they eventually start rebuilding. They
right.
eventually start doing things again. And, you know, maybe that's what we need in order to get things back on track. I hope not. I would rather it be just a, okay, we can still keep our cultural institutions if we can actually, like, figure out how to make them work again.
Yeah.
And how we have to do that is we have to say, okay, you got to respect other people's sovereignty to do things the way they want to. So I thought we might, I realize we're kind of running kind of long. I thought what you might want to argue with me is about like the Roe v. Wade case and how like, oh, that's horrible and stuff. Right. But do you want the American empire to say, yes, every woman gets to have an abortion? Or would you rather have self-governing societies where you can be part of the one that's cool with it or not be part of the one that's not cool with it? Same thing for me. I mean, the hard one to say is guns. Do I want to be part of the thing that says, yes, everybody gets to have all the guns they want because the empire says so? Or do I want to say, no, self-governing societies get to decide for themselves how they're going to do this stuff. Go live in the one that suits you.
Yeah, I mean, maybe I'll surprise you, but I think with abortion rights, it's like, it's another one of those things where I do think we should win the hearts and minds of people mm-hmm. about the practical reasons why we should.
Which I think we pro-lifers need to do too. I think we need to
talk about the let's have these debates. I'm always a fan of like, let's have these debates, not let's have a top-down authority tell us,
you know,
because the look at the backlash that Roe v. Wade has had. I mean, the way that the Republican Party is able to use the abortion debate to get votes.
Which is why I thought they'd never actually do it. I thought they'd keep using this as their thing to get people to rally
around.
Well,
now it's every state, you know, has it that they can continue to do it because now it's up to the state. So now it's going
to
become...
You know what would be fascinating, though, for the Democrat Party to try to do?
Hmm.
Someone pointed this out to me. I was like, holy crap, you're right. In light of saying, hey, this isn't mentioned in the Constitution. It's not said as a federal
right.
issue. The Democrats could come around and say, yeah, just like Roe v. Wade, you know, that like abortion is not a enumerated right in the Constitution. Nowhere in the Constitution does it say the feds are in charge of immigration.
Hmm.
And so you could have 50 different immigration policies and all of
That's
the people
funny.
Who want to build the wall
yeah.
and who want to do all that stuff. You'd be like, build your own piece of it. But here in whatever state I live in, we're not doing that. We're going to have our immigration. But, and I mean, that's another one that people have been doing sanctuary cities for a long time.
Yeah.
Like, and you know, sometimes right wingers look at it and say, well, man, I want a sanctuary city for my guns. I'm like, right, absolutely.
Right,
sanctuary city for your guns. These people are going to have a sanctuary city for people coming from other countries and everything. Oh, so actually, it's funny I mentioned that, but honestly, Democrats could make hay with that if they, you know, idea for those of you who are left of center who want to try to use that mechanism of things. Absolutely, go for it. Say, okay, if we're saying the feds have nothing to do with this, start doing it with stuff that you care about.
Yeah.
Just like apparently the Republicans are doing that right now with stuff that they care about.
Yeah.
you know, it's funny. This what's the real difference between like the paleo conservative and the libertarian and everything? Mm-hmm. What do they think about immigration? Because when I was paleo conservative, it was kind of like, no, like we're Americans, nativism, you know, if you want to come in here, you have to do it legally and everything. Nowadays, I don't know that I give a crap because it's like, look, free market means that people can contract to do whatever business relationship right. they want. So if somebody wants to bring in whoever to work for them, what business is that is anybody else's? And so, like I said, free market purism actually got me to come around to say, I guess I don't care then that much about.
Yeah,
immigration status kinds of things. Although, again, we're probably the people who want to just let everybody in here will get mad at me again and say, oh, but I believe in absolute property rights that like, okay, sure. As far as, you know, we can have a porous border and that there's plenty of countries that make that work. But then you just say, yeah, you don't get to like, you don't get to trespass on people's property without them letting you be in there. That's a different question. You ask, what do we do about the defense question a long time ago in this conversation. Sorry, I didn't circle back to it. That was the whole thing that a lot of the founders didn't believe in a standing army. They didn't want to have a standing military at all. They're like armed citizenry. Mm-hmm. You know, the thing about the Second Amendment at the federal level, some of it was, it is talking about the individual citizen has the right to bear arms, but some of it was, oh, also the people have the right to form a militia. Mm-hmm. Like, you can have people form militias, and that's going to be our defense system, so that we don't have to end up having an imperial army like the Brits did.
Yeah.
And so, absolutely, I wish that American history had stuck to the community-based militia model. I think we would have stayed out of a lot of trouble if we'd done that. The United States might look pretty differently, but I think we'd be a lot freer, because, again, there is something to the, you know, the military-industrial complex wants to keep itself, wants to self-perpetuate.
Right. And
so they got to have big armies to do that. They got to have big toys to play with. They, you know, for them to keep sucking off the, you know, at the teat of government, they got to keep having reasons to justify their existence.
Right.
So, yeah, they're going to constantly be advocating for us to get involved in stuff that we shouldn't. Whereas if it's literally, you know, some people laugh at the idea of, really, rednecks with guns are going to be our defense system.
Right.
It worked pretty damn well in Vietnam and in Afghanistan and all these places. Rednecks with guns can do a lot more than you think.
Well, yeah, but the Vietnamese took heavy, heavy casualties. So
when you're fighting on your home turf, which is what we'd be doing, Americans could put up one hell of an insurgency if we actually I don't want us to have to do that. But the question of like, well, what if terrorists come in? That's why we have the Second Amendment. You know, that's why we have the right to bear arms. If you, you know, you can walk around armed.
Well, we also probably wouldn't have terrorists fucking with us if we weren't over there fucking with them. You know, so I think Ron Paul takes care of that problem.
Too, and he had a lot of guts when he told the Republicans, we've been messing over there for a long time. There's a reason why this stuff happened.
We've kind of been asking for it. So.
Yeah. you know, but I was someone who bought the propaganda hook, line, and sinker. When like, why would they attack us? We haven't messed with them. Yeah, we've absolutely
they hate our freedom.
I know. I'm sorry. That was me for a long time. And look.
No, you were young.
If we were, had a model of, you know, citizen militia service being the thing, I'd probably still do it.
Yeah.
You know, I wouldn't have a problem with, because I served in the National Guard. Which is done state by state.
Right.
I wouldn't have a problem with still like maintaining that kind of service because it's like, right, you're getting together, you know, a couple times a year and you're practicing marksmanship and unit tactics and you're practicing doing some other things. But like, if we don't have to have our, the American empire around the world, there's not a need for us to do a whole bunch of things that the military industrial complex does. So I don't have a problem with military service per se. Again, when it's a thing that like we're thinking in terms of what are we going to do if we have the Red Dawn scenario where we're getting invaded and everything, I think we could have something that is plenty adequate for defense, without having it be this giant machine that we've turned it into, which is the very kind of thing that a lot of the founders were like, no, we cannot do that. We got to get away from that kind of thing. Unfortunately, America has become the British Empire 2.0.
Right.
And I don't want us to be that. We need to stop being that. That's the biggest piece we have to do as far as getting to some kind of reasonable, sane thing. I know there's a lot of people.
I think this is something you could agree on with the most leftist, anarcho-commie, whatever person.
Hey,
the American Empire is a problem.
You know, this is where it's funny. Like, I'm further to the left than the biggest leftist out there when it comes to we got to get rid of the American Empire. I'm like, no, I actually mean it.
Yeah.
Like, we got to get rid of the American. And to those of you out there who don't know this, you'd be surprised. There are people who are considered right wing who don't want to have anything to do with the American Empire. I mean, heck, there's more and more right wingers who are becoming suspicious, like suspicious of cops.
Yeah.
And they don't want, you know, there's people who are like, yeah, wow.
Why do we have a militaristic why do we have cop this thing? Situation?
And, well, if they look at it and when they see riots happening in cities and they're like, wait, the cops are just standing there and being told to stand down.
Right.
While people are destroying things. They're like, well, why do we have
what you? Is the point of this?
Yeah. What's the point of having you? And so there, I have seen articles where they've already said, it is time to defund the police, but from the right wing perspective. And then they make the argument saying, basically, the only thing we want is the county sheriff. And I'm right. like, I'm down. I'm Look, totally down with that. And
this is why we do this podcast, because it turns out most people really are politically non-binary if they take a look in the mirror and figure that out. And that they have so much in common with other people that they might think are
well, like, I mean, I still opposites. Expect there's probably plenty of things that you and your listeners are going to think I'm crazy. But I'm saying that the beauty of, like, if we got to self-government and doing small is beautiful and all that stuff is... You can largely have what you want, and I can largely have what I want, and we can peaceably interact and everything. Whereas if we're going to have this giant empire that we're going to constantly struggle for control of it, we're going to be at each other's throats all the time. I don't want that.
Yeah.
I'd rather live my life and raise my kids and be happy and everything. If we cannot do this, I think we're going to break up one way or another. Either it's going to come through stuff shooting or our dollar is going to fall apart because of the stuff we don't
have. Right,
that's another podcast episode sometime. But, you know, things are going to get ugly if we don't fix this. And if we still refuse to fix this, hopefully we can build something, build back better. We can make it right again the next time. But hopefully we can, like, remember and transmit to our kids and to future generations, look, you don't, you know, it's okay to come back and start over and to come back and say, okay, let's work out what the social contract actually needs to be.
Mm-hmm.
What's the future really going to look like? I have a few ideas. I don't really know. You know, there's a whole bunch of people who write theoretical books about this stuff.
Yeah.
I'm just saying with the cultural institutions that we do have that have been passed down to us, let's try to use those to move this in a healthy direction. I think the way to go is decentralize.
Word.
That we've got to get back to America. You know, I had an argument with another relative of ours because I was like, see, if I were to use the phrase and make America great again, I don't mean it the way Donald Trump does.
Right.
Like, oh, we got to bring back whatever. No, I mean, let's go back to America being these small little entities
right. in
different places that can interact peaceably and don't have to, you know, that we don't like America being great again would be us pulling out militarily. We can still be business involved with everybody else,
right.
but we can pull out militarily from places all over the world. And, you know, we can stop being the empire. We can have a reasonable tax policy. I know that some, you know, libertarians will get on me because taxation is theft. I know, I know. But I'm just saying if we could, I would like to abolish the entire thing, but I'm willing to settle for traditional American federalism. Because
mm-hmm.
I think it will give us the best chance of everybody having what they want.
Sounds
or
good.
Most of it. If we can't do that, you know, okay, don't come mess with me and mine. I know it's going to get ugly for a bit, but I'm going to do the best I can for the people that are in the community I live in. But yeah, please, I'm pleading with everybody. Please, can we just try to do localized government rather than tyrannical government,
because
you can at least put a lid on that if you see problems in your own backyard.
Yeah, it's easier for it to have the government answer to us if it's more local.
Yeah. Right.
Well, good. One more question.
Yeah.
Is there something that you would say, like, if you had to choose one thing to ask people to change in their lives to make the world or just the country a better place, what would that be? One practical change. Mm-hmm. Like, is all this stuff is so theoretical.
I know
so
it
just
is.
So one thing, and it doesn't even have to be related to it can, but it doesn't have to be related to this.
This seems weird to you because I know you're not like super into religious stuff these days, but somebody pointed out to me that like actually the real way to implement the stuff I want as far as like government becoming unnecessary
is to have other cultural institutions take its place.
You mean that we can evolve the parallel economies and we can turn can come up with things so that the government versions of stuff become unnecessary and we don't have to have them anymore. Yeah, I've heard that argument. But one of the things he actually told us is that like we need to be because he's making the Christian appeal of like, we need to, if we can be Christ-like, if we can be good people, a lot of this stuff becomes unnecessary. So what I will say is like, please, like, be virtuous people. You don't have to be religious necessarily, but like a lot of the stuff that I'm asking for, it's actually rooted in stuff like the Golden Rule.
Yeah.
As far as, you know, why is it wrong to infringe on other people's rights and to, because treat others as you want to be treated, you know, respect their rights as much as they, as you want them to respect yours. If we are, you know, this kind of goes back to some of the founders were like, look, it's, you have to be a moral and religious people. I don't know that you have to be religious per se.
But you need to be virtuous.
You need to be a virtuous people in order for something like self-government to work.
Right. I think so, that's such a, like all these cultural changes you're talking about, whatever, like we've lost so much of the concept of real virtue and like having an understanding of what virtue is.
So my plea to people is be honest, be fair, be reasonable. You know, someone like me who's going to be, who's going to say, I don't want the state to do charitable things. I don't think they're good at it. I think they're very wasteful.
And the rest of us need to.
What I'm saying is then the rest of us need to be virtuous. We need to be the ones who are doing the things in those communities. There are places that have made this kind of thing work where you say, great, yeah, we're going to take care of the people that have mental health issues. We're going to take care of the veterans. We're going to take care of the people who are sick. We're going to take care of all these things. The more that we as people, as human beings, see each other as fellow human beings who have lives and who have opinions and who have rights that are worthy of respect, and the more we look at each other as like people that are, who are worthwhile, you know, see each other's humanity, we should want to take care of each other. I want it to be so crystal clear that there is no need for coercive government to do good things because we're already taking care of this stuff.
Right. Let's do it ourselves.
Let's do it ourselves.
Do you have a favorite charity you want to shout out?
Like locally or like?
Yeah, on either level. I mean, like if you have a favorite either charity or some way to volunteer that you care about. Sure.
I mean, locally, my wife and I are involved with a thing called Soup and Ladle that's about teaching kids in low-income areas in their schools like how to cook so that they can like, you know, actually know how to use ingredients rather than, you know, being tempted by convenience food and that kind of stuff. I mean, I could mention them. They're nice people.
But that's true. Like finding an organization that's local to you. I do
church stuff, which is, again, helpful. Like, you know, if you're religious, churches are a great.
They organize charitable things. That kind of stuff. Well, that's something that I realized in leaving the church, you know, the Mormon church and whatever, is that I'm like, OK, again, it's one of those areas where like, you know, atheists, agnostics, whatever. We're so smart. We don't need religion. Right. but then you go,
a lot of them think that.
But what I'm saying is, it's like, so do you do any charity? No, some do. But there's somewhere it's like, oh, you're so stupid. You're paying tithing to your church or whatever.
That's why some of them turn to the status, because you're still looking for someone to fix the problems and someone to worship. And so there's a lot of people that it's easy to let the state become your new religion.
When it's also just easy to not give at all. If you're not giving to a church, it's just easy to not give at all. And if we are going to, if we don't want big government and or we don't want big religion, you know, well, you have to do your part yourself. Yeah. And so it's like, make sure that you actually are. Yeah.
Be the change you want to see in the world.
Be the change.
Can I be so cliche as to say that? Be the change you want to see in the world. Be the person that volunteers at the soup kitchens, at the homeless shelters, at the, you know, things. I mean, there's another one that Miriam and I have certainly worked with plenty because we've done a lot of, you know, work with foster kids and that kind of stuff. You know, there's local charities that organize clothes and all kinds of things. And it was amazing to us to realize just how much resources there are out there for people who are doing that.
Yeah.
Because there's so many people that want to help and want to give. But yeah, find your local thing that, you know, that does that stuff. If we can do that, I think there comes a point where who even cares if the state is doing a library anymore?
Right.
Because we have all these other resources that are available.
Look at all
who even cares if the state is doing a women's shelter anymore? Because look, we already have all these other things that are already doing the job.
Like, right.
So yeah, if you know, you're gonna peg me on it. Yeah, I don't like the idea of the state coercing tax dollars out of people in order to build libraries either, even though I love libraries and I use them. I think there's like other mechanisms that they could come about by. But I mean, honestly, we've already kind of seen the start of the bottom-up problem to this. Haven't you seen the little local free libraries?
Local free libraries, audible.com. So you can,
They do this stuff, and I think every time we drive by one, my wife and kids want to go and see what they have in there. Maybe we'll drop off some books, too, and, you know, we do these kind of things. there's ways where we can even share resources, if that's your goal,
right,
that don't have to be through the mechanism of the state. And I'm just saying, please get out there and do those, you know, right. do the things that make our communities good, so that when the totalitarians come and say, hey, we want to take things over, they don't have the easy excuse of like, look, nobody's providing the thing that right. we need.
Yeah. Be the change.
Don't give them the room to be able to do that, because make it so obvious that, like, no, all the needs that people have come up with are being addressed voluntarily rather than coercively.
Yeah.
So there you go. What's the label you could really use to describe me? I'm a voluntarist.
Yeah.
I'm not an anarchist or a minarchist, although I'm willing to navigate the spaces in between these things.
But
I'm
it's better when people are volunteering.
Voluntary society is what I want.
Yeah.
And I think voluntary society will give you what you want to.
You're an voluntarialist.
I'm a voluntarist.
I like putting my name into things. Voluntarialist.
Voluntarialist.
Sweet. All right. Thanks, Joel. This was great.
I hope it was fun. Yeah. Thanks. Mm-hmm.
All right, it's Ariel again. I hope you enjoyed that episode and that you got some things out of it. If you have thoughts about anything that we've talked about, especially if you have disagreements, if you have follow-up questions, if you have points of clarification that you would like to make, if you think there's anything we got particularly wrong, particularly right, or interestingly wrong or right, then you can hit me up. Whether you just want to discuss it with me to clarify my thinking, or if you want to be on the podcast, then hit me up. Email me at ariel.norman@gmail.com, ariel.norman@gmail.com, or you can find me on Instagram at ellendegenderless, or if it's about this podcast, then it would be nice if you would go to my Instagram for the podcast. I'm buying time because I need to make sure I know exactly what it is. Politically NB, that's what I thought. Okay, I have a Instagram, Politically NB, PoliticallyNB, as in the letters NB, not spelling it ENBY, but Politically NB on Instagram. You can follow there. I don't post too much on there, but I do like to post little stories and posts every now and then of things that I come across, little memes that are politically non-binary or whatnot, but it's also just a good place to message me if you want to either be on the show or provide some input about any of the things that we talk about. So yeah, rate, review, subscribe, go to politicallynb.substack.com to support the podcast. There you can do a free subscription, you can pay me, and if you want to support me, my comedy, my podcast, just Venmo me at gayariel, gayariel. I love my sugar daddies and sugar mommies and sugar people. If you want to be my sugar person, thank you so much. And thank you to everyone who does support me, whether on Venmo or Patreon or Substack or just in life. I have a really great support system of people who, you know, love me and or what I'm doing. You don't have to even love both. You can just pick one and support me by giving me food or a place to stay or, you know, being on the podcast or telling a friend about it, whatever. I love any way you want to support me. I do keep my bills nice and low, although I would like to start having more money because I like to have more money to spend on travel and gifts. I want to buy people gifts and be able to, you know, just pay for an Airbnb. I sleep in my car sometimes, just so you know, just to save money so that I can do more comedy and buy people more gifts and whatever. I would rather sleep in my car sometimes while I'm on the road than be able to buy people some happy little muffins from a little Japanese bakery. Anyway, okay. Enough about me, enough about everything. I think I've said enough. Join us next week or two. It'll, you know, these things come out whenever they come out, but join us soon for my friend Anusha, who argues that people should actually be getting out of STEM and into the humanities. More basically, that was basically what we talked about this morning. So that will be the next episode. And then there's going to be, like I said, much more Patreon Substack content coming. So thank you for being here. Thank you for listening all the way to the end. If you listen all the way to the end, wow. Thank you. You're the coolest. You're the coolest of everybody. Okay. Love you. Bye. Big thanks to our producer, Raymond Cabrera, our art guy, Caleb Sexton, and our sponsor, Texas Yurt Co. at texasyurts.com.